Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, May 2nd, 2018. We'll start with the news section. Bringing down the house. Old West Durham residents are battling over the soul of their neighborhood. I guess you found it all right through all the construction, asked Dan Welch, a resident of Old West Durham, over the din of jackhammers and dump trucks. Two new houses are going up next door. Compared to Welch's quaint single-story house from the 1940s, these taller, wider structures would fit better in the suburbs. Welch says he's not against our new construction. He just wants what's coming to match the character of what's already there, charming mill houses that have existed in this area for decades. He's not alone. Welch and dozens of his neighbors have spent years lobbying the city for a designation known as Neighborhood Protection Overlay, or NPO, which adds to the city's existing zoning regulations in a particular neighborhood. If they're successful this week, Old West Durham would become only the second neighborhood in Durham to have an NPO. This, they say, is their best chance at reducing teardowns and holding on to the elements that make their neighborhood unique. But the proposed NPO regulates more than just the size of houses. There would be limitations on bulk relative to a house's lot size and a maximum height of 26 feet. The NPO would also mandate a canopy tree in every backyard and limit the height of accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, to 20 feet. Developers, of course, don't like the NPO, as the restrictions would inhibit their profit margins. But neither do some homeowners, including John Temple, an OWD resident since 1964, who argues that by trying to reduce new construction, the pro-NPO crowd is harming efforts to keep housing prices in check. In a letter to the city council in April, Temple wrote, "I think the NPO would only result in fewer folks in each house, and that would also cause rents to rise. Families that have more children should be able to enlarge their houses without being forced to move to another neighborhood that does not have such arbitrary restrictions." Indeed, on March 13th, after several drafts and 16 public meetings, the City Planning Commission narrowly rejected the NPO on a 5-4 vote, a clear blow to NPO supporters. A statement from the meeting explained, "The commission believes that the request is not reasonable and in the public interest." On May 7th, the application goes to the Durham City Council, which has the final word. Already, residents on both sides of the issue are bombarding City Council members' inboxes. One of the emails in support of the NPO came from Heather Gavallen, an OWD resident of over 18 years, who complained that the likelihood that our lot will eventually be robbed of sunlight, airflow, and privacy from both sides by for-profit, non-resident landlord developers is greater than ever before. This NPO application is part of a larger trend toward neighborhood protection in which well-meaning homeowners limit development projects in an effort to keep their neighborhoods intact. The problem, according to many urban planners, is that neighborhood protection initiatives sometimes do the opposite of what residents hope for. Economists say that by limiting the supply of housing, the added regulations often make prices skyrocket. That, in turn, leads to neighborhood exclusivity. Joshua McCarty, an urban analytics researcher, says that the minutiae of regulations on height and bulk can sometimes dissuade developers from contributing to a diverse marketplace with many options for renters and buyers. "Prices in Durham are going to rise regardless of an NPO," he said, "and cutting supply will only exacerbate the problem." Instead, McCarthy suggests The neighborhood should support incentives to build duplexes, townhouses, and other multi-unit properties that would increase housing availability and thus improve affordability. But as NPO supporters point out, affordable housing does not seem to be a primary concern for most developers in Old West Durham. In scenarios where an older, smaller single-family house is being replaced by a newer, larger house, there's little change in supply, but a large difference in price. In the short term, at least, the price hikes could be enough to force renters to move somewhere else. Old West Durham residents began exploring the creation of the NPO in 2012 and submitted their proposal to the city in 2014. Although the initiative wasn't precipitated by a single event, supporters say they were generally concerned about the area's rapid growth and fears that those trends would accelerate in the future. Because the Durham City Council Planning Department lacks sufficient personnel, officials there only began working on the NPO last year. Since NPOs are proposed and backed by residents, they're a uniquely democratic process in the world of city planning. This is probably the only zoning tool we have that really allows neighborhoods to essentially write their own destiny to some degree, says Matthew Filter, a senior planner for the department. Durham is changing, and OWD with it. The neighborhood's vast tree canopy, proximity to 9th Street, and relative affordable prices, it's not uncommon to pay under $1,000 a month for an older rental, make it a desirable location. Most of all, neighbors say OWD is known for its porch culture. As opposed to the impersonal anonymity afforded to suburban dwellers, small lots and walkable streets encourage OWD residents to use their porches and lawns to enjoy the weather, chat with friends, and share meals. But lately, the trees are dying off as they reach maturity. Housing prices are exploding, and some small village houses are being torn down and replaced by larger homes that tower over their neighbors. 19 homes in the neighborhood, out of 428 parcels of land in OWD, have been demolished in the last decade. The newly constructed homes that replace them are generally larger and thus more expensive. The average size of a house built in the 1990s was 1,769 square feet, compared to the average size of 2,828 square feet in the 2010s. The pro-NPO group argues that welcoming construction and renovation while limiting the size of new houses will make each unit more affordable than what's currently being built. Supporters compare a traditional mill house from 1956 that rents for $1,085 a month to a house constructed last year, priced at $2,750 per month. Perhaps no one has aroused the NPO supporters' ire more than developer Jeff Monsine, who owns 53 properties in the neighborhood. Monsine, along with business partner Chris McKeel and fellow property owner Martin McFarling, said he's been astonished at the vitriol to which he's been subjected. The neighborhood's listserv is dotted with posts that condemn Monsine's development excesses. One post last year hinted that one of his houses could have been burned down in order to build a larger duplex, albeit with no evidence to support that claim. The developer also says his anti-NPO signs are frequently stolen from properties that he owns. In the 1980s, when Monsine first bought a property in Old West Durham, houses were selling for between $20,000 and $40,000. Now some of those houses are going for more than $500,000. Demolishing the original residences to build bigger houses had proved to be a lucrative model for many landlords, including Monsine. He believes he just got lucky. There was no way to predict the upsurge in home values. It's not like we're scheming somehow, he said. This just happened. But detractors say that the things that Monsine does have control over, like ensuring that his newer houses match the neighborhood, have been disregarded for the sake of profit. Some of the developer's properties snugly fit into the designated lots and rise above the surrounding structures. That led critics to refer to them as monstrosities. Monsignor admits that many of his newer homes are larger and pricier than the originals. For instance, one currently available property rents for over $3,000 a month, and its accessory building unit costs about half of that. Still, he believes that development is reinvigorating a neighborhood that would otherwise be falling into disrepair. Monsignor points to neighborhood properties that have been neglected and wonders why residents haven't targeted them through their proposed overlay. He notes the metal carports that some residents have constructed in their backyards, which could also be considered uncharacteristic of the neighborhood. But Ellen Degenhardt, a real estate agent who owns and rents out a house at 1900 Virgie Street, says that over her nearly 40-year career, she's rarely seen a property that's too far gone for repairs. In many cases, she insists, tax credits for historic preservation can help cut the cost of renovation. And even if the renovations take more money and time to develop, Degenhardt believes that the red tape is worth it to preserve the character of the neighborhood. The thing that hurts about this is that they're going through to the city to try and impose regulations on us when it seems like the neighborly thing to have started with would have just been to come to us and say, what are your goals as an investor, and can we work out something reasonable here? The NPO supporters say they have tried to reach out, but the developers rebuffed them. And Wells flatly dismisses the idea that the NPO will hurt the landlord's business prospects. The developers are trying to paint themselves as victims of all these people that are trying to steal away their livelihood, he said. Another way to frame it is that these investors are doing really well. The rents have about doubled in the past 10 years. They really shouldn't be considered victims in this. Instead, Wells suggests, the real victims are renters, who make up 57% of the neighborhood, according to the Planning Commission. Welch says that they often get priced out of the neighborhood when new houses are constructed. A major point of contention for both sides is the lack of an official vote on the NPO from the residents who will be affected. In Durham, it's not required, so there's no way of knowing for sure if a majority of the neighborhood really supports the initiative. But all indications suggest that that's the case. Those who have shown up to community meetings tend to support the NPO. At a November meeting, even the least popular aspect of the proposal were backed by 70% of the respondents. In addition, a private survey taken by the anti-NPO camp showed that OWD residents support the NPO by a nearly 2-to-1 margin. Both renters and, albeit to a lesser degree, property owners back the additional regulations. The only other NPO in Durham was established in Tuscaloosa-Lakewood in 2008. It shares many features with the one proposed in OWD. Both limit house size and address issues related to tree cover. Other North Carolina cities have a long history of implementing citizen-led zoning initiatives. In Raleigh, there are 19 resident-driven overlay districts. In Chapel Hill, there are about 10. Neighbors in these districts had some of the same concerns as the citizens in OWD. Largely the more recent overlays were seen having been aimed at reducing teardowns and subdivisions. Subdivisions of a single lot to build two or three houses where there was one, says Bynum Taylor, a senior planner for the city of Raleigh. We're definitely seeing, with the ongoing growth, pressures both post-recession, a greater interest in historic and neighborhood conservation. Even the most ardent supporters admit that the NPO won't stop the wave of gentrification cascading through Durham. But one thing that both sides can agree on is that this debate is not really about architecture or zoning. Rather, it's about finding a way to curb growth while promoting inclusion and affordability. The problem is figuring out what the balance looks like. It remains unclear whether the NPO gets to the heart of the matter or is simply the last gasp of an effort to resist inevitable change. Our next news article, Break the Cycle. 700 people come home to Durham from prison each year. A homecoming celebration aims to welcome them with open arms. On Thursday night, a crowd lined the wooden pews in the sanctuary of Durham's First Presbyterian Church. As one might expect, there was prayer, singing, and references to Bible verses. But this was no ordinary service. It was a celebration in the spirit of traditional church homecomings across the South of the 700 or so people who come home in Durham from prison each year. The reentry homecoming was a joint effort of the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham and the county's local reentry council, which formed last year to coordinate reentry services. While it's the first time the coalition has thrown this kind of public event for returning residents, it's been working with the county's Criminal Justice Resource Center for about 15 years to help residents make that transition. While the CJBC and the Reentry Council connect returning residents to jobs, housing, and other resources, faith teams trained by the Religious Coalition provide companionship, support, and a sense of accountability. Each team and its partner, as returning residents are known in the program, enter into a year-long commitment to an honest, judgment-free friendship. The coalition is about to train its 20th faith team. When it gets really cool is when they start arguing with each other about who has benefited the most, about how much they've learned and that they didn't know, or how much they're going to gotten from a different perspective. That's the space we get really excited about, because it starts to reopen or open these really different ways of understanding what community can look like. The work is rooted in the idea that all people have an inherent worth and potential that is not diminished by their mistakes. Thursday's homecoming served to acknowledge not only that worth, but also the ways in which society has allowed systems of mass incarceration that dehumanize people, even after they serve their time, to continue. The wraparound approach CGRC and the coalition create is necessary because of the barriers returning residents face. Private and public housing landlords may deny a potential tenant based on criminal history. People with records may be barred from jobs, professional licenses, public assistance, and rights like voting. According to the North Carolina Justice Center, more than 900 state and federal law deny rights and privileges to the approximately 1.6 million North Carolinians with criminal records. About 92% of employees in the state conduct criminal background checks on applicants, according to the Justice Center. While many employers in Durham have agreed to ban the box on job application, asking if applicants have been convicted of a crime, Demetrius Lyon, the local reentry counselor's job placement specialist, says it can still be difficult for justice-involved individuals to find work. Many earned certifications during their time in prison, but because they were locked up, they don't have hands-on experience in the job they want. According to the North Carolina Department of Public Safety, between 60 and 75% of people are employed 1 year after returning from the state's prisons. This lack of opportunity, coupled with the pressure to provide for family, has been living without the person's income or to fall back in with an old social network, adds to the risk of reoffending. Among people who left North Carolina prisons in 2013, 48% were rearrested within 2 years, and 21% were reincarcerated. Too often, people who are still in prison are forgotten until they get released. Reentry starts inside, says William Elmore, one of the three speakers Thursday night. Elmore spent 25 years in prison before starting a support group for the families of people who are incarcerated. Wilbur Pipkin said he spent 8 years in prison and left angry with the system, but eventually he was persuaded to join the county's reentry program and work with a faith team. He says it was the best thing that ever happened to him. "People began to show me love, and it was something I hadn't felt before," he told the crowd. A third speaker, who asked not to be identified in the story, says working with the religious council taught him to take responsibility for his actions. 5 years after his release from prison, he's still close friends with a team that began writing to him inside before he returned to a Durham that had drastically changed during his 7-year sentence. With their support, he started a business flipping houses and doing landscape work, and he made a point to hire people with criminal records. "These four volunteers chose to help a stranger, and I wasn't going to waste their time," he said. The next news article, failure to communicate. Orange County's emergency communication system is outdated, but fixing it will cost a ton of money. Orange County needs a major update to its emergency communication system, but how, when, where, and how much will it cost depend on crucial decisions by county officials in the near future. In the balance could hang the high-speed internet for underserved and unserved populations, as well as the safety of emergency medical services workers and the people they serve. In an emergency, communication is key, but Orange County EMS has had difficulty with that. 10 years ago, the county switched from an analog radio system to a digital one, which had an unintended consequence. EMS workers couldn't use their radios inside some buildings. "Our radio system utilized by fire, rescue, and police is outdated and routinely places our emergency workers at risk," Sheriff Charles Blackwood told reporters last week. The sheriff, up for re-election Tuesday, says he's worried about what might happen in the case of terrorist attack or school shooting. In schools, hospitals, and public buildings, the weak radio signal has trouble penetrating walls. In these cases, EMS workers rely on cell phones to stay connected. Blackwood warns that cell phone lines can become jammed in mass emergencies, adding another hurdle for rescuers. In 2007, the county joined in the state's $83 million Emergency Communications Initiative, VIPER, which stands for Voice Interoperability Plan for Emergency Responders. The county contributed new interfaces, and VIPER increased the number of EMS workers who could talk at once by giving the county access to more radio frequencies. It made organizing calls easier because they could be routed by someone sitting at a computer. But the state and county have different needs for the system. The Highway Patrol uses car-monitored radios from the roads, which is a very different situation from using a handheld in a building, says Orange County Emergency Services System technician Pat Campbell. "The state has little incentive to solve the inter-building communications problem," Campbell said. "This means Orange County is on its own." Federal Engineering, the county's consultant, is scheduled to release a request for proposals to update the system in September. When lawmakers receive bids, they'll have to weigh the cost as much as $20 million, according to Commissioner Earl McKee, against the urgency. "I'm not willing to pull money away from other needed services in order to address this on a narrow time frame," said McKee. At the same time, the county is considering an upgrade, and so is the state. In April, the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division recommended an appropriation that would keep Viper running while replacing equipment and upgrading outdated software. No matter what the state does, the county still needs new communication towers to increase coverage and improve signal strength. These can be expensive eyesores, but communities might get something out of it. Not just improved EMS capabilities, but also faster internet services. And that, McKee said, may be a way to reduce costs for a new communication system, selling space on towers to internet providers. In 2014, Orange County identified underserved and unserved internet coverage areas, along with sites for fiber towers to increase internet speeds. Campbell said these same sites could be shared for EMS towers. The locations have not yet been made public. And now, the $50 million question. Will a huge verdict against Murphy Brown force Big Pork to clean up its act? Last Tuesday, as the first of 26 scheduled nuisance trials against pork giant Murphy Brown LLC came to a close, the U.S. District Court Judge Earl Britt slowly turned his chair and gazed at the 10-person jury box. Britt, an octogenarian, Jimmy Carter appointee with a soft drawl, had just finished reading jurors their instructions, a task that took more than 20 minutes. He leaned back and left the courtroom with a parting thought. "My only comment is that I am tired of looking at that dirty hog," he said, glancing at the life-size, foul-waste-coated fog replicas that have been sitting inside the courtroom for the past 3 weeks. Spectators reacted with surprised laughter, as they had throughout the trial when the normally no-nonsense Brit made an unexpected quip. But the cost of filth painted onto that pink plastic hog was more than a punchline. It represented the root of a dramatic case that had played out in court over the month of April. The trial is at its core was about pig feces and whether the world's largest pork producer should be held accountable for the way they manage the tons and tons of waste that its hog farm produces. This case marked the beginning of a series of landmark trials and lawsuits filed by more than 500 neighbors of hog farms against Murphy Brown, a subsidiary of Smithfield Foods. The plaintiffs in this and other lawsuits argue that the farm's method of disposing of hog waste products was unbearable. It caused stenches that adversely affected their quality of life. That waste management system, common in large hog farms in North Carolina, functions by storing pig excrement in open-air lagoons and then liquefying and spraying the waste onto nearby fields. Among other things, the plaintiffs allege that the odors and mist from the spray drift onto their property, and hogs attract swarms of flies, buzzards, and gnats. Boxes filled with rotting dead hogs produce an especially obnoxious stink, and the stench has prevented them from spending time outside, having barbecues, and even opening their windows. With 25 more lawsuits pending, this first trial's outcome was closely watched as a potential bellwether. Whom would the jury believe? The corporate giant, whose Chinese parent company was worth nearly $13 billion as of 2017, and whose attorneys claimed these lawsuits were ginned up by money-grabbing out-of-state lawyers? Or the farm's mostly working-class and largely African-American neighbors, who say the corporation's greed has made their lives miserable? Indeed, the vast majority of the plaintiffs involved in these cases have lived on their land for generations, and two UNC researchers found that the state's industrial hog farms disproportionately affect minorities, a phenomenon, they concluded, is a generally recognized as environmental racism. To remedy the problems alleged in the lawsuits, Mike Kaske, an attorney representing the 10 plaintiffs involved in the first trial, argued in his closing statement that in the absence of strict state regulations, a major financial penalty would force the industry to change. When dealing with multi-billion dollar corporations, he said, money talks. A hefty payout could prevent Murphy Brown from committing similar wrongful acts. As he made his case to the jurors, who had patiently absorbed the technical details of hog waste management for weeks, he motioned to the plaintiff sitting quietly in the courtroom's hard wooden chairs. "We're asking you to fight for these people," he said. "You 10 are able to do it. Today you are more powerful than the governor of North Carolina and the attorney general." 2 days later, the jury gave Murphy Brown a spanking probably more severe than even Keskey had dreamed of. Its verdict? An eye-popping $50.75 million judgment. Alone, that sum was harsh. But should the next 25 juries follow suit, the result could be calamitous for the company, perhaps as much as $2.5 billion. If money does talk, as Kanksy implored the jury, Murphy Brown is now a hell of an incentive to invest in proven alternative waste disposal technologies that can ameliorate many of these complaints. As Michelle Nowlin, the supervisor attorney for the Environmental Law and Policy Clinic at Duke Law, told Indy in an email, "This verdict favors the industry to internalize and reckon with these costs. I'm hopeful this decisive victory will be a game changer in North Carolina and force the industry to modernize its waste treatment to the benefit of rural communities, the environment, and the farmers themselves." If the judgment stands, that may well very happen. But thanks to a North Carolina law passed 2 decades ago, it probably won't. Instead, Murphy Brown will more likely get a slap on the wrist and go back to business as usual. And that's exactly the outcome the state corporate interests and the lawmakers who did their bidding had in mind. This first lawsuit, McKinley versus Murphy Brown LLC, was brought by neighbors of Kinlaw Farm, a Bladen County operation that contracts with Murphy Brown to raise about 15,000 hogs. During the trial, Murphy Brown attorney Mark Anderson likened the farm to a peaceful slice of pastoral heaven, displaying a series of picturesque photos for the court. "The farm is gorgeous, beautiful, and well-maintained," he told the jury. "Then the operator of the farm has a party," he added. "They do it right there on the property." The plaintiff's lawyers countered that pigs produce 5 times as much waste as humans, and concentrated animal feeding operations, CAFOs for short, in North Carolina, often contain thousands of hogs in confinement. The hogs on Kinlaw Farm produce about 153,000 pounds of waste a day. The lagoon-to-spray-field model of waste disposal, critics have long argued, has been put in place to cut costs. The attorneys suing Murphy Brown say that the company has refused to invest in alternative technologies that would minimize the odor, such as covering the lagoons and converting the sequestered methane into electricity. But those and other alternatives are expensive to implement. According to Keskey, the cost of covering all the lagoons in North Carolina would total about $500 million. About half of what Smithfield Foods makes each year after taxes. Between 2010 and 2015, he told the jury, 4 Smithfield executives earned a total of $245 million. The industry built these operations into a way because it was the cheapest, he said. They won't change now because they don't want to spend the money. Anderson chafed at the implication that the industry's waste disposal system is motivated by avarice. Instead, he pointed out that the lawyers suing Murphy Brown were asking for money, not a fix to the problem. He added that he was frustrated listening to all the talk about big corporations, big money rhetoric he called anti-corporation and anti-agriculture. The jury didn't buy it. On Thursday, junior jurors awarded each plaintiff $75,000 in compensatory damages, and after finding that Murphy Brown committed fraud or acted with malice or engaged in willful or wanton conduct, $5 million in punitive damages. The outcome enraged the industry. In a statement, the North American Meat Institution said it represented a blow to jobs in the state's economy, fueled by anti-animal agriculture rhetoric. According to the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, U.S. Agricultural Secretary Sonny Perdue called the verdict despicable. It's horrible if that's the kind of money that people are awarding. Republican State Representative Jimmy Dixon of Luplin County, an outspoken industry ally, bemoaned what he described as the attack on family farmers by greedy out-of-state lawyers, telling the Indy that the verdict marked a very sad day for consumers who have enjoyed an abundant supply of safe and economical pork products. Last year, Dixon sponsored House Bill 467, which aimed to head off just this eventuality. The bill, which passed over Governor Cooper's veto, limits the amount of damages property owners can collect in nuisance lawsuits filed against agricultural operations, including hog farms. Had Dixon got his way, he would have also essentially negated the 26 pending lawsuits against Murphy Brown, including this one. However, that provision was stripped from the bill before it passed the House. The best noteworthy response came from Smithfield, which immediately and unsurprisingly promised to appeal. Much of its statement was predictable. The company called the lawsuits an outrageous attack on animal agriculture, rural North Carolina, and thousands of independent family farmers who own and operate contract farms. These farmers are apparently not safe from attack even if they fully comply with all federal, state, and local laws and regulations. The lawsuits are a serious threat to a major industry, to North Carolina's entire economy, and to the jobs and livelihoods of tens of thousands of North Carolinians. But in a separate email, Smithfield spokesman Joyce Fitzpatrick brought up what is likely to be a central point of contention. Even if the company's appeal fails, she points out that under North Carolina law, punitive damages are capped at 3 times the amount of compensatory damages, or $250,000, whichever is greater. In this case, that means that each plaintiff would be limited to an award of $325,000, bringing the total judgment down from $50.75 million to $3.25 million. To a company as large as Smithfield Foods, that's chump change, the cost of doing business, not an incentive to alter behavior. The bill, sponsored by Republican State Representative Charles Neely, now a lobbyist and attorney at the Raleigh law firm Williams Mullen, passed amid a wave of total reform legislation that followed the so-called Republican Revolution of 1994. Pushed by the North Carolina Citizens for Business and Industry, a coalition of the state's largest companies, the legislation aimed to, in the words of a lobbyist, prevent frivolous lawsuits that are intended to frighten businesses into settling. Neely, who was out of the country Monday and could not be reached for comment, explained at the time, "We shouldn't wait for a crisis to fix the problem." According to Nowlin and two outside legal experts consulted by the Indy, the plaintiff's lawyers declined to discuss their strategy after the verdict. Smithfield's interpretation of the law is likely to hold up. Even though this trial took place in federal courts, they said the state's cap still applies. The lawsuit was fought over a state statute and was only heard in federal court because Murphy Brown is incorporated in Delaware. For the same reason, Dixon's House Bill 467 can restrict future nuisance lawsuits, even ones filed in federal court. The short answer is, I don't think there's any grounds to challenge the punitive damage law, says one expert, a longtime North Carolina trial attorney who spoke on background on background because he's not directly involved in the case. In 2004, the North Carolina Supreme Court upheld the law. Not only does North Carolina law limit punitive damages, but it also forbids a judge from informing the jury about that cap. The theory, it seems, is that if juries wanted to punish a company for bad behavior, but knew that the amount of punitive damages was tied to the amount of compensatory damages, they would simply jack up the compensatory damage award. In keeping jurors in the dark, the law works to further shield large corporations from big verdicts. In addition, the cap hasn't been adjusted for inflation since 1995. If it had been, according to the U.S. Department of Labor's online inflation calculator, the $250,000 maximum would now be set at more than $415,000. The other legal expert, also a longtime trial lawyer, who knows and thinks highly of attorneys on both sides of the case, says that if the plaintiffs want to get around the cap, they'll have to develop a novel legal theory. The attorney floats one such possibility. Can you count each day as a separate offense? In other words, if a court were to find that each day that the plaintiff suffered because of Murphy Brown's willful or wanton conduct, as a punitive damage statute puts it, was it worth $250? That could add up to $5 million. In the end, Judge Britt has to apply the cap, and this attorney cautions against assuming that he'll do so. Instead, that decision might fall to an appellate court. As of press time, neither the plaintiffs nor the defendant had filed any post-verdict motions. Even assuming the cap stands, a string of difficult verdicts could take its toll on Murphy Brown. If each of the more than 500 plaintiffs in all 26 lawsuits is awarded $325,000, the amount the first 10 seem likely to receive, the company would end up forking out more than $160 million plus attorney's fees. For that reason, the second attorney wouldn't be surprised to see Smithfield settle the remaining cases. Its lawyers, after all, saw how the first jury reacted to their case. There's little reason to think subsequent juries will react differently. This has not hurt the plaintiff's bargaining position, the attorney says. But the bigger question is whether the verdict and any settlement that follows will lead to meaningful change. By their very definition, punitive damages are designed to punish bad behavior, so as to compel reform. But here, because the corporation being punished is so large, the punishment meted out might not be sufficient to obtain the jury's desired results, especially considering that the legislature has already cracked down on future nuisance lawsuits. And with the cap in place, any settlement is likely to be far less than what it would cost the company to cover its CAFO's lagoons. As the first trial attorney laments, "We have these laws that protect the man behind the curtain. It's very frustrating." In the background is this. Although the industry claims that it is among the most regulated sectors in the state, critics say the regulations in place are insufficient and have become less comprehensive in recent years. The number of animal and annual inspections in the state hog farms was slashed from 2 to 1 in 2011, following budget costs under the former governor, Pat McCrory. Tom Butler, a Lillington hog farmer who testified for the plaintiffs during the trial, told the Indy last year that the hog farm inspections have become increasingly relaxed over the past 2 decades and now essentially consist of a paper audit. The North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality denies that claim. Butler also pointed out that farmers are given up to a week's notice before their farms are inspected. "If we do have any issues, we can get those cleared away because we know the inspector is coming," he said. "And the inspection process itself relies on self-regulation, as the inspections draw from the farmer's own records." If the state won't rein in bad actors, the attorney says, then the only other recourse is the civil justice system. But if the civil justice system restricts jurors' ability to determine what's fair and what's not fair, then what check is there on corporate misdeeds? Horrendously bad behavior, he said, deserves horrendously bad punishment. But in North Carolina, the law says otherwise. Our next article is entitled True Love. After podcasting about the dark side of human nature with Criminal, its producers step into the light with This Is Love. The adage about not fixing what isn't broken certainly applies to the winning formula developed by the Durham-based true crime producers who created the national podcast phenomenon Criminal. Their newer effort, This Is Love, which was released 6 episodes since Valentine's Day, doesn't stray far from their signature anthropological approach. It's just that now, instead of cops and robbers, the focus is love. But it still features Phoebe Judge's soothing vocal timbre and the steadying hand of producer Lauren Swoffer. Producer Nadia Williams is still on board as its engineer, Rob Byers, and illustrator Julianne Alexander, who alongside her signature artwork details the trials of her parents' romance in the first episode. As part of a live tour organized by PRX's Radiotopia podcast network, Judge and Swoffer will appear at the Carolina Theater on May 8th to tell a story about streakers, probably unheard on Criminal. That evening also features storytellers from 6 other PRX podcasts, including Radio Diaries, The Bugle, and The Illusionist. We've recently spoken with Judge and Sporer about the literary approach to podcasting, the virtues of small stories, and the life on the road with a bunch of podcasters. Then they ask, "You two and your team are already some of the hardest working producers in podcasting. What compelled you to branch out with a second podcast?" Phoebe Judge replied, "When we started Criminal 4 years ago, we were obviously interested in crime. But that's not all we were interested in. We're interested in 1,000 other topics, and after doing just Criminal for 4 years, we thought it was time to stretch our wings a little bit and challenge ourselves and hopefully make something that complements Criminal, even though it's a topic that's totally different." The indie, Criminal has been called a broad reading of the true crime genre. This Is Love certainly follows that description. Was it difficult to shift your storytelling to a new genre? Lauren Swoffer replied, "Phoebe and I have worked in public radio for a long time, so we don't come from any sort of investigative background. When we started the show, we were thinking that we wanted to make something that didn't already exist. We were thinking, what if we used a New Yorker long thread as a model? So we had sort of literary ambitions from the beginning with Criminal. But our background is not in crime. Our background is in telling good audio stories. To do the love stories was sort of a return to some skills that we haven't gotten in use in a while, which is to find people we find to be delightful. It was very exciting for us to do it with love because crime is obviously very broad, and I don't think it gets much broader than love." The stories range from romance novelist in her process to a widower living here in the Triangle. How do you find your stories? Phoebe replied, "For a long time, we've been thinking about the love show, and we were stalking because we couldn't find that perfect story. We were looking for these big, grand stories, and then we finally said, maybe we're trying to find something too big. We've never been good at finding big stories. We've always been good at finding small stories, personal stories. So when we got out of the mindset of finding something grand, we found the perfect batch of stories. Unlike with criminal, we actually have relationships with some of the people in This Is Love. We looked around at people we have known and finally just said, wait a second, you would make the perfect episode. The thing that dictates about what we choose is what we're curious about. The indie said, you completed the first 6-episode season of This Is Love and have 6 more episodes slated for the fall. How's the response been? The answer? Wonderful. The marker for a wonderful response is that we have people writing that these stories have touched them in some way. People have said these stories made them feel good. They've also said that they're crying a lot in public, which we don't hear as much for criminal. But our hope was to make a show that would make people have some faith in humanity and surprise people and give them a break from everything else that is going on in the world. And I hope we've succeeded in that. From the indie, Radiotopia kicks off an East Coast tour in Atlanta on the 7th, and the next night brings you to Durham. What can we expect? The answer? It's great because you get to see a collection of podcasts all doing their own thing and performing live on stage. You're not just going to see Criminal. You get to see 99% Invisible and Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything and the Kitchen Sisters present. These are all shows we've admired for so long. It's fun to see these podcasts that you usually hear live and see what people look like. For us, we don't get much audience engagement. I have no idea if someone is smiling or frowning or falling asleep. But now we get to look out into the audience and see the person's immediate reaction, and it's been great for us. The indie went on, last year you toured with Radiotopia on the West Coast. How was that experience? The answer, it was so much fun. A lot of these shows are grouped together in the Bay Area in L.A. or in New York, so they get to see one another and go out for drinks and pitch in if someone had an editorial question. But we're our own down here, so it was a lot of fun to get to spend time with the Memory Places, Nat DeMeo, and the Kitchen Sisters, and sit around and share meals. The indie, how's life on the road? Are you on vacation or are you in working? They said, we're always working. Criminal does not stop whether we're on the road or not. We work with Nadia Wilson, so she will stay and hold down the fort while we're gone. But yeah, we'll keep looking for stories. We'll keep doing interviews while we're on the road. In the past, we'd find a studio in the city we've made in and go and track the next episode or do an interview if we have to. We're usually editing the script or thinking about the next episode, and so we're always on the phone with Nadia in North Carolina. The only thing we know for certain is that Criminal will come out twice a month on a Friday, and so we just plow ahead. And finally, do you have a preference between playing on the other side of the country or a couple of blocks from your home? Their answer, it's always nice to be doing it in your own backyard. The Triangle community has been incredibly kind to Criminal. When we did our first live show 3 years ago at Motorco, I was convinced that no one was going to show up. I was terrified. I didn't know what we were doing or why we thought we could do something like this. People showed up and how they loved it and were so kind and generous. We've always felt incredibly supported by Durham and the Triangle. It's where we live. With Election Day fast approaching, we have one more last chance to listen to the Indies' endorsements for this election locally. For Wake County, the Board of Commissioners, Sig Hutchinson, District 1, Matt Calabria, District 2, Irv Portman, District 4, James West, District 5, John Burns, District 7. For Durham County, District Attorney, Roger Eccles, Sheriff, Clarence Burkhead, Board of Education, Mike Lee, District 1, Matt Sears, District 3, Natalie Beyer, District 4. In Orange County, Clerk of the Superior Court, Mark Kleinschmidt. Board of Commissioners, Sally Green, at large. Earl McKee, District 2. Board of Education, Sarah Smiley, Brenda Stevens, Hillary McKenzie, Will Atherton, and for Sheriff, Charles Blackwood. U.S. House, District 2, Republican, no endorsement. District 4, 2, Democrat, Wendy Ella May. District 4, Democrat, David Price. State Senate, District 6, Democrat, Luis Toledo. State House, District 11, Republican, no endorsement. Democrat, Allison Dahl. District 33, Democrat, Rosa Gill. District 35, Republican, no endorsement. District 35, Democrat, Terrence Everett. And also, early voting is available for one more weekend in Durham County at the Durham County Board of Elections, 201 North Roxborough Street in Durham, May 4th, 9 to 6, May 5th, 9 to 1. At Duke University, Broadhead Center, 402 Chapel Drive in Durham, May 4th, 9 to 6, May 5th, 9 to 1. East Regional Library, 211 Lick Creek Lane in Durham, May 4th, 9 to 6, May 5th, 9 to 1 p.m. At NCCU One Stop, 640 Nelson Street in Durham, May 4th, 9 to 6, May 5th, 9 to 1. At North Carolina Library, 221 Milton Road in Durham, May 4th, 9 to 6, May 5th, 9 to 1. South Regional Library, 4505 South Alston Avenue, May 4th, 9 to 6, May 5th, 9 to 1. Orange County, Orange County Board of Elections, 201 South Cameron Street, May 4th, 9 to 5, May 5th, 9 to 1. Cameron Towers Hall, 301 West Main Street in Carrboro, May 4th, 9 to 5, May 5th, 9 to 1. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning. Thank you.